Welcome to the second episode of the NFAC Conversations podcast. I'm Jackie Weprook, General Manager of the National Farm Animal Care Council. This podcast episode is a recording of a panel discussion moderated by yours truly from a March 2022 NFAC members meeting featuring retail, restaurant, and food service representatives and members of NFAC. Panel members were Angela Griffiths from ANW, Jason McClinton from Retail Council of Canada, Paolo DiMano from Recipe Unlimited, and Michael Yaramovich from Aramark. The panel was such a hit amongst NFAC members and so informative that we decided to release it as a podcast episode. The panel provided their insights on the value and use of and expectations for the codes of practice for the care and handling of farm animals by both their company and the broader sector, how food companies can support the achievability of codes of practice, the expectations for on-farm animal care assessment programs, and much, much more. It was an engaging and open conversation that also provided some fun moments where we got to know more about the panel members at a more personal level. Participant questions and the answers by the panel to those questions are also included. A bit of a caveat, the audio quality is not great as this was a Zoom recorded discussion that was part of an NFAC meeting. There's also a spot in the podcast where we did a survey of NFAC meeting participants to engage them on the question, how much do you agree or disagree in the citizen-consumer paradox? In other words, the attitudes of citizens as found via surveys on willingness to pay for animal welfare attributes and how that differs from what consumers actually buy at grocery stores or restaurant food service establishments. Now, obviously, there's no visuals in a podcast, but the discussion around the survey was super interesting, so we decided to leave the survey-related audio to provide that additional context on the conversation that was happening. So let's get to it and enjoy. So after we do a brief introduction of each panelist, we have a fun question for each of them that is going to help us get to know them a little bit more. So we've heard the message that we all need to get to know each other a little bit more and build some relationships here. So we have some fun questions after the intros. So I'm going to start with Angela's introduction. So for those of you that maybe don't know Angela, she joined Food Services at A&W in June of 2016 as the Vice President of Food Safety, Quality Assurance, and Animal Welfare. And prior to that, she held the position of Director of Innovation for UL Supply Chain and Sustainability from 2010 to 2016. She has a Bachelor of Science from the University of Western Ontario, a Master of Science in Microbiology, and a PhD in Resource Management and Environmental Studies from the University of British Columbia. So pretty impressive, I'd say. We'll save the question for her in a bit. I'll keep with the introductions. So Paolo DiMano is the Senior Director of Strategic Sourcing for Recipe Unlimited, specializing in proteins and commodities. He helps lead a team that procures on behalf of over 20 restaurant brands, majored in economics at York University, and then flipped into culinary training. And so this blend of disciplines has led to progressive roles in food service, where he's worked in operations, training, marketing, and procurement. And so Paolo represents Restaurants Canada on the Chicken Farmers of Canada Board of Directors and is the chair of their Consumer Relations Committee. So busy guy. Michael Yaramovich. Mike has been working in sustainability at Aramark for 11 years, first as a manager and now at the director level. And we stole from his LinkedIn page. And I can attest to this. He's a diplomatic and conscientious person with a diverse work experience. That really sums up Michael. He's always a pleasure to work with and to speak with. And makes him also a perfect fit for this panel. He has a BA in history from Concordia and a certificate in environmental practice from Royal Roads University. And then finally, to round out our panel, is Jason McClinton. And Jason has 20 years experience in government and regulatory affairs, both within the federal government as a former regulator with Health Canada and Environment Canada, and in his current position as Vice President of the Grocery Division and Regulatory Affairs with Retail Council of Canada. And you guys have something in common, Michael and Jason, he holds a graduate degree in history from Concordia University as well. So, did you guys know that?
Did not know that.
There you go. Yeah, pretty awesome. You already know more about each other than you did when you started this. All right, so we're going to have a fun question for each of you, and actually, I'll start with Jason. So, Jason, as the retail representative on a panel otherwise comprised of restaurant food service experts, we thought you might like to tell us about your earliest or best memory of eating in a restaurant or food service establishment, and you do not need to name the establishment, depending upon what you want to say.
Go for it. Thanks. Thank you, Jackie. And maybe I'll start by saying, like, wow, what a panel. I'm very humbled to be on a panel with such amazing folks with, you know, that's a really impressive a couple of bios there. So thank you for the invitation to be part of it. I did read the question ahead of time, and I thought of my earliest memory. Am I allowed to name the restaurant, or should I not?
Well,
okay, I won't.
Totally up to you.
I won't. And I remember as a kid growing up in the suburbs in outside of Ottawa that we were so excited to go, so excited, me and my siblings, to go. But there wasn't one in the suburbs that we grew into. And we would, you know, we had to convince my parents to bring us in. And I remember very fondly celebrating my birthdays there. There was a playground and stuff like that. So I have very, very fond, I think that's probably my earliest memory of dining out at the restaurant.
Well, thanks so much, Jason. All right, Michael, you're next for the question. So as one of our food service members sitting alongside a retailer rep who has the same educational background even, we thought you may have some thoughts on that age-old dilemma of grocery shopping while hungry, or I think as we call it now, hangry. Research confirms that hungry shoppers don't always make the healthiest food choices. So if you were to shop on an empty stomach, what would be those foods you simply could not resist in the grocery aisle?
Actually, that one is pretty easy for me. If I'm hungry and I'm in the supermarket, I cannot go down the ice cream aisle. If I do, I'm going with, I got to get a second cart. And I have a particular problem with those, the ice cream stick on sticks with like covered in chocolate with the almonds in them, you know? Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. And I'd also like to echo Jason's comments about being humbled to be part of this this panel, and thank you for doing this. I think it's a great opportunity for us to talk about some of the issues from our perspective. So thanks, Jackie, and to the entire group.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks. We will get into more serious questions soon, but. But we know what to buy you as a gift. I mean, ice cream with the nuts and on the stick, and yeah. Okay. We'll add that to what we know about you. All right, Paulo. So we know you were really busy traveling this week, and we're not sure when you first started traveling again after COVID, but whenever you did, what would you say was the thing that you miss the most about traveling, and what would you say you miss the least? Because we all need a good travel story for some of us who are still haven't gone anywhere.
thanks for the question. And, I want to echo, I always coach my team that, be careful, you're judged by the company you keep. So if anyone wants to judge me while on this panel, I think I'm in good stead. I think I straddled the line between people who are traveling and folks you refer to who haven't, because this week was actually my first week of travel. So I haven't been on a plane in 2 years. I still remember March 11th, 2020 was my last flight. So this week was a little odd for me. Just physically leaving the house and being away from my family for the first time created a little anxiety. Once I got out of the house, it became old hat, and you fall into routines. But I gotta tell you, as a creature of habit, some of those habits fell, and where I used to proudly be able to say 3-day trip, no problem, I'll get by with this backpack, there I am with two bags, forgot my headphones, so I'm listening to these tiny little Air Canada things. So you know, just getting back into the swing, but just being out and about and actually, you know, just being out in hospitality in restaurants and having some live contacts is really what I missed.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Yeah. I packing a suitcase again. Oh yeah. That's scary. All right. Last but not least, Angela. So we know you live in beautiful North Vancouver. And also noticed a lovely picture of a mountain range on your LinkedIn page. So the question for you is, what is your favorite outdoor activity and why?
Oh, that one's easy for me too. Thanks for the comments from the panel. I'd like to echo them as well. It's a great panel to be on. Yeah, that's an easy one for me. I am a avid backpacker. And I don't do it as much as I used to be able to do, but last summer I did a 5-day hike to Bird Lake in Mount Robson Park, if any of those of you are familiar with that. And this summer I've got a plan to get flown into a trail off Nootka Island. They're going to drop us in water. I'm a little bit concerned because I'm not much over 5 feet tall. So I'm hoping it's not going to be over my head. They said knee deep. So let's hope that's true. And I live for the hiking in the summer.
Oh, well, whenever we get back to meeting in person, I think you and Hans can share some hiking stories.
All right. Sounds good.
Yeah. 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 Awesome stuff. Awesome. Well, there, I think, you know, it that was actually fun. That was really fun to get to know you guys a little bit better and what great answers you guys all had to each of your questions. All right. So we're going to move on to the serious stuff now. So we have a number of questions and we'll fill up our time, I think, quite easily. If anyone does have questions for the panel, please, you know, feel free to throw them into the chat. I'm going to ask a few questions and we'll see if there's any questions from the attendees. We also have some a couple survey questions for you. So we're really hoping to make this a very engaging session for everyone. So this is NFAC. So the first questions are going to be about the codes of practice, because that's what we like to talk about around here. And we'll start with Angela and we'll go through each of the panelists for each of these questions. How does your company use the codes of practice? And if your company doesn't use the codes of practice, maybe, you know, let us fill us in as to why not.
Sure. We definitely use them. So as a bit of context, animal welfare is one of our five pillars for our doing what's right strategy, which is essentially our sustainability strategy. And within there, we commit to ensuring that our supply chain meets the requirements of the code. So as of today, we audit at the processing level at the abattoirs, but we're not auditing in the at the farm level at this point, because we're relying on the implementation of the codes in the sectors that supply us. And so, and I mentioned a few minutes ago, every new corporate staff member goes through an animal welfare orientation where they learn about the codes and why they're unique. And so we're, you know, we very much support the code process and execution of them and make sure everyone in our organization knows about it.
Awesome. Awesome. Very cool. Michael, do you want to tackle that question next?
I think, you know, right off the top, I'll say, to be fully transparent, I don't think that we really use them within our business, at least not nearly to the extent that we could or should. And I think part of that stems from the fact that, you know, we're a global company. We're in 20 countries. And there's a lot of pressure for us when we're coming up with whether it's a policy or even just something that's less official than that, when we're trying to come up with a strategy for improving animal welfare within our purchasing. There's a lot of pressure for it to be a one size fits all kind of a thing. And as Angela mentioned, there are, you know, NFAC is unique. The codes of practice are unique. And so it's difficult, I think, sometimes for when you've got a round table of people who represent international business to incorporate the nuances or the specifics to something that is Canadian into a more global approach. Right? There's a lot of efficiencies or perceived efficiencies in trying to come up with that one size fits all kind of approach. And I know on several occasions, we've found that to be a barrier when we are trying to integrate the codes of practice a little bit more into our overall strategy. So,
No, thanks for that, Michael. That kind of transparency is important, and of course the challenges are going to be different for every organization. Paolo, would you like to go next?
Sure. Thank you. The codes of practice actually are a great launching pad and reference point for us. You know, when we're trying to inform ourselves and either trying to develop a standard, put a stake in the ground, or just better understand what exactly we're serving, a great starting point is actually going back to those codes of practice. And you know, we have great reverence for them because, you know, they are through, you know, that Canadian lens and through a, you know, a multifunctional or multi, you know, a multi, I guess functional group that provides oversight on them, right? So, you know, we have lots of questions, queries, be it from guests, be it internally, even from our staff that want to understand, you know, why am I selling this? Should I feel good about, you know, about this product? And the codes of practice give us a really good, credible, defensible launch pad in terms of understanding where we are from a global perspective, because there's a lot of misinformation out there, or you can get snippets about competing products or products coming in from other countries where they might celebrate, you know, one attribute and ignore a lot of other things that go on in that country. And so we really look at, you know, NFAC as you know, we look at it as a differentiator versus other countries. We don't really want it to be a differentiator within our own. You know, we like having a standard code of practice. We don't think that animal welfare and care should be a competitive advantage. We really like that it is constantly under review and keeping up with the times, and that, you know, all boats would rise with the tide.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Paolo. All right, Jason, well, you're not with a specific company. You represent an association made up of many, many members. So, we'll let you answer that however you want to take the angle on that one.
Yeah, thanks.
Do I need to repeat it? Are you good with the question, or how the codes are used?
Yeah.
Or does the code use it?
Yeah, and I think that you encapsulated it right. Like, so I'm here on behalf of the Retail Council, and therefore not a specific retailer, but rather the sector as a whole. And I think I'd echo a lot of what the other panelists have said, in that it would be difficult to overstate the value of NFAC and the NFAC codes to our members. Because everyone's at the table, right, in their development, from academia to producers to NGOs, retailers, food service, right? It truly is a unique model. And I know that, you know, and we represent, you know, very large national grocery chains. We represent regional chains. Like, everyone's different, and they're all in competition with each other. But most, if not all, have corporate social responsibility programs, and I know that they lean heavily on, in fact, codes of practice as a foundation, foundational in terms of developing those. And every time I have a conversation with a member, like, not a single one has been different. Every time I have a conversation with a member, they speak so highly of NFAC and the NFAC codes and code process.
Cool. Oh, that always makes us feel good when when that's our aim at NFAC, of course, is that awareness. And then, kind of, Jason, you've kind of almost answered the next question, but I'll ask it anyway and just and see if you have anything further to add to it. And you answered it in your last bit there, but in terms of the awareness, the overall awareness within your sector as a whole of the codes, and it sounds like it's pretty good, certainly within Retail Council of Canada. Yeah,
it's very, very high. It's central. Like, so the Retail Council of Canada has an animal welfare committee we meet, oh my God, probably every 2 months or something like that. So several, and that's more than any other committee that we have, right? Mm-hmm. We have food safety committees, product safety committees, and others. Mm-hmm. And that is, we meet on a very regular basis. And the discussions around codes, code development is central to those discussions. So I would say that the level of awareness is very high. And I think that that has actually increased over recent years. The profile has actually gotten higher and higher over the last several years.
Cool. That's great to hear. Really great to hear. We're doing something right. Yeah. All right. So I'll go to Paolo. We'll work our way back now. So how aware overall do you think your sector in the food service industry is aware of the codes of practice?
I would say, you know, as a general rule, I would say as an organization gets larger and they're resourced more and they're challenged more, I think those organizations are very aware and, you know, do it A, to understand what they're doing, and B, to help defend what they're doing, quite honestly, what they're sourcing. Within our own organization, I would say it's a specialized group. People who are in procurement and, you know, in charge of CSR and whatnot are a lot more aware than folks in marketing or operations, and we could probably do a better job. But industry-wise, I go back to, you know, probably my opening comment there saying there's a very big chasm in terms of people understanding or knowing what's going. You know, our industry is vast, and, you know, you can cover everyone from, you know, a little coffee shop or a little independent to, you know, you people with multiple thousand units. And I think, you know, what I'm beginning to realize is maybe through restaurants and Restaurants Canada is we can do a better job in terms of just helping people understand and just feel better that there is a system. Very few people, I think, will dive deep. But there are, you know, we do have members that are almost exclusively about, you know, being progressive and, you know, being on that leading edge of animal care and environmental and the environment. And they'll be very heavily in. And other members would probably just like to know that it's being considered in the back, and there is this body that is credible that is doing the thinking for them.
Great. Awesome. Michael, we'll let you tackle that one next.
Sure. Yeah. And I would say from our industry, so and to define kind of a little bit more what that is, you know, we call ourselves a managed service provider, and the main market that we serve is the institutional market, right? So public sector, schools, hospitals, and beyond, a lot private as well, but our biggest business still remains within the public sector. And I would say that amongst our, the industry that serves that, so ourselves and our competitors, I think there's a very high level of awareness. Where I'd say it drops off is for the clients that we serve. I talk about NFAC a lot when we do reviews, business reviews with our clients, you know, and very often, I would say most of the time, for many of them, it's either the first time they've heard of it, or there's a very kind of a low recognition level of what that means. They understand, you know, once they start talking about it, they understand what it represents. They're happy to hear about it. They're happy that it exists. Mm-hmm. But there's not a high level of awareness amongst our client base. And by extension, I think also within a lot of the customers that we serve. But I won't go down that road yet. I think just between with us, within our industry, on the service side, level is high, and amongst the clients, it's still rather low.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Michael. Well, you know, you want to be a bit of an insurance policy. It's there if it's needed, and you can point to it when if something does happen. Yeah. All right, Angela. How aware do you think the overall the restaurant sector is on awareness of the codes of practice?
Yeah, I think Paolo said it pretty well. It's it is a huge sector, and it does range from, you know, tiny restaurants, which I'd say the awareness is very low, to larger organizations like ours that pay close attention to it. But yeah, so it's really mixed.
Okay, great. All right. I'll I've got one more question, and then I think we're going to try and speed things up a bit so that we can have a survey question as well. But this is a really important one, and also I'm keeping an eye on the chat, and I think Hans is too, to see if we have any questions that are coming from anybody. So, you know, if anybody does have a question after this question, we would like to see if anyone wants to bring something forward. So we'll start maybe with you, Paulo. What are the expectations for the codes of practice from your company and your customers? It's an important message, you know, that to deliver to those that are developing codes and implementing them.
Yeah, you know, I think it's pretty simple. I think we want them to be clear, transparent, and audited or enforced. So, you know, we have some credibility when we're out there, you know, either, you know, rationalizing, you know, our source of supply or defending ourselves when people question our source. You know, having a baseline that is national in scope and clearly articulated. It has a ton of value, and the other thing that's important to us is that it's alive, it's evolving, you know. So as processes change, as technologies change, as just sentiment changes, we know we need a skilled group to weigh different options and whatnot, because you know there's nowhere that the law of unintended consequences comes into play more often than in animal agriculture, where you know you could think you're doing a great thing, or you're hearing something from another jurisdiction in the world, and you know you just want to jump on and adopt that, and you quickly learn why it might not work in this environment, or what the you know what might go wrong there. So having you know this live body that is vetting things and continuing to evolve is super important to us.
Great. Jason, do you want to tackle that one next?
Yeah, I do. And if I may, I also might make a comment on something that one of the other panelists said with regards to the last question. But to begin with, you know, in terms of expectations of the code, I think really the two biggest themes that come out in my discussions with members are one, continuous improvement, right? I think that, you know, these codes, as I said, at least from where I sit and in all the conversations I've had, are unique. They are really seen as a model, I think, globally. But the idea of always looking to see how we can further improve these world-class codes, I think is really an expectation that retailers have. And that I think that NFAC has been delivering on, and the codes have been delivering on. The other one is, and I struggled with the word that I wanted to use for this, I ended up with the word support. So support from all parties, or support from all stakeholders. And why did I struggle with the word support? Well, by definition, anytime you get a bunch of stakeholders around the table, and you talk about consensus building, you know, I think almost by definition, you're not going to have any one party jumping up and down saying, oh my God, that's exactly what I had in mind before I even entered this discussion, right? There's a little bit of give and take that happens. And that's why we get together, right? I remember when I worked for government and we were developing regulations, I would often joke and say that I only knew that I got the regulation right when all stakeholders were equally unhappy with me. If there was one stakeholder that was too happy or too upset, then you know that was a bit of a red flag. And I don't think that applies in this case. And again, I don't know that support's the right word, but I'll use it. I think support from all parties and a spirit of continuous improvement. And if I may, Jackie, you know, I heard one of the other panelists, I think maybe a couple, you know, talking about the level of awareness of the codes within their organizations and within their sectors, but then mentioned the idea of the opportunity being with consumers. And I would echo that for sure. It is a real opportunity, I think, from a retail perspective as well, because on the business end of things, I think the level of awareness of what NFAC does and what the codes are is very high. But I think we have a real opportunity to increase that level of awareness with consumers.
Yeah, and definitely NFAC has not focused on on the public so much, unless the public comes to us directly. Yeah. All right, Angela, you know, what are A&W's expectations for the codes and your customers' expectations as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there's two pieces to it in my mind. I mean, one is that they have to be kept up to date, that focus on continuous improvement. We can't point to a code that's 20 years old. We do have to have them updated. The second piece of it is not as much a direction for NFAC specifically as it is for NFAC's members. And that is that not only do we need to have up-to-date codes, we need to have them implemented across industry in a way that's transparent. And, you know, that's really important. We need to know that they're being implemented, ideally that they're, you know, it's a robust program with auditing and verification and those types of things, so that we actually know that the suppliers that we're buying from are in fact adhering to the codes. And so we would like to see more transparent reporting on those audit programs, as an example, that industry does carry out today. But again, those only have as much credibility as the codes themselves, which really do have to be updated on a regular basis for us to use effectively.
Okay, great. Thanks, Angela. Mm-hmm. Michael.
Yes, thanks. I definitely agree with everything that's been said so far. And what I'll maybe add to that as well is, as far as expectations for us, I think it's an opportunity for us to simplify a message that often, that's a complicated one. Animal welfare is a complicated issue. And what the codes give us the opportunity to do is, it's a touch point. It's something that gives us a chance to point to something to say, look, there is a process in place in this country, a good one, something that we can point to, as I said, to show whether it's in conversations, as I was talking about earlier with a client, whether it's an opportunity to try to educate our consumer and give them a positive news story for something that's happening, or something that there may be, that there's definitely a growing interest in. So, you know, if I use another example if I point to something like certifications and other areas, often what we've managed to do with, whether it's something like a fair trade mark or a sustainable seafood mark or something, there's a recognition that goes along with those. As the recognition of those programs grows amongst consumers, it's an easier way to deliver, like I said, what can often be a complicated message. So our hope is that, building on what everybody said about making sure that obviously we need to have all those things in place, the consistency, the clarity, or the transparency, in order for that public trust to build. But once it's there, once it's established, then having the symbol of the codes itself is something that's very useful for us to help with educating the consumer on that, and provide more information about what we might be doing as a commitment through our purchasing, in the power of the dollar, so to speak. So I hope that makes some sense. But
no, that's great. And if anybody ends up wanting some, I see Paolo, you have your hand up.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. I just wanted to add a little something, something that came up a few times was continuous improvement. And I'm thinking some of my producer friends just, cringing a little bit and saying improvement for the sake of improvement. And I want to speak to that a little bit in terms of that, this is never a sort of thin end of the wedge type scenario where we're driving things just for the sake of doing them. And really, I'd probably characterize it more as continuous improvement and validation. Sometimes you will get to a standard where you're in the right place, and globally you are a leader, and it's not necessarily about incrementality, but it's just validating and knowing and comparing and auditing and making sure. I think about my producer friends and them sometimes being suspect of why there's this constant pressure. And really it's from my perspective, it's about doing the right thing and just making sure you're in the right place. It's not incrementalism just for the sake of it.
Good point. Good point. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we have one question that's popped up, and I know we're going to have to speed things along because we have a lot of questions for you guys, and you guys are giving us such great in-depth answers. So Lynn Kavanaugh, who's with World Animal Protection, is asking, what influences companies to make animal welfare commitments that are stronger than requirements outlined in a code? So who wants to tackle that one?
I can start.
Great.
Yeah, and thanks for that question, Lynn. And I think, you know, it's been mentioned on this panel already that consumers are central, right? From and certainly from a retail perspective, right? Is that retailers want to meet consumer demand. And as those shift, both, right now we're talking about animal welfare, but there's all kinds of sustainability issues and even just different types of products and things like that that consumers are looking for. That's a really, really big one. Also, every retailer has their own corporate vision and mission, and they have their own set of values. So, you know, a lot of them, you know, they all make their own independent business decisions. But I think an obvious one too, in addition to all of that, is just availability, right? Because consumers want a lot of things, as they should. And so while they're looking for things that are ethically sourced, they're also looking for things that are affordable for themselves and their families. And I think that's particularly important now in this context of historic inflation. So I think probably a third factor, in addition to, you know, consumer demand and individual retailer decisions, is you know, product pricing and availability, at the risk of stating the obvious.
All right. Anyone else want to add to that, Paolo?
I might jump.
Okay. Everybody's got something to say. That's great.
I'll go super quick here. I would add on to that, that it's definitely helpful when it's collaborative. We have outside groups either trying to work with, it feels like they're either trying to work with us or against us. And I will tell you from experience, the ones that get our ear and have more influence on us are the ones that are collaborative. And we also just want to know that, you know, we have some sort of shared vision. We want to do the right thing. And that's not a marketing thing. That is just, we have associates across the country and we need them to be proud to come to work, and we want to do the right thing. So, we want to improve. So we're happy to work with anyone with, you know, a shared mentality. If, you know, going back to my last comment on continued improvement and incrementalism though, you know, if the end goal is the end of an industry, we're not necessarily aligned to talk to them. We prefer to work within the industry to make it as good as it can be.
Great. Angela.
Yeah, just to echo, I mean, we're balancing on a tightrope or on the point of a pinhead, in terms of, we do have to be very responsive to consumers, you know, as in the restaurant industry, anyway, we're making the purchasing decisions on behalf of all of the consumers that come to our restaurants. So they're a critical part of those decisions. The others is, you know, we actually look at the science and read the technical documentation and the recommendations as well as the requirements. And then for us, the third piece is, we have long-term relationships with suppliers, and are they able to make a transition in a feasible way? So balancing that kind of economic feasibility with consumer demand, with what the science is telling us. So you know, those could be the reasons we'd go above and beyond. But we usually are still basing them in the recommendations of what would be in the NFAC code.
Yeah, great.
And Jackie, if I could add to that as well, I think there's a couple of really important sources of influence. One are definitely, these decisions don't come from a sort of a round table of people that are not experts in the field. They are informed by a lot of different areas, and often animal activism is a loud one. We are influenced and we do listen, and we are influenced by what is being said there. It can be a very loud and passionate group. And they're representative of a large portion of the consumers we serve. So we owe it to them to listen. And so there are sometimes there is that pressure to go above and beyond. Simply competition. I think often there are any company would want to show themselves to be just a little bit better than their competitors. If one person is saying, here's our standard for animal welfare, you can see that there may be a lot of pressure on another one to say, we do things even though they do this and we go above and beyond. So,
Yeah, no, that's great. And it actually leads into the next question I want to ask, but I want to bring the attendees into this as well. So we're going to post a Zoom question for you guys. And so this is, I'll read it out to you. And I think it pops up, but I don't think we can get all the words because Zoom is limited. So what we're interested in is, and we talked about this a little earlier, some of you mentioned it already, is around that whole citizen consumer paradox. So, the fact that as citizens, we say we want a lot of things. And then when we walk into the grocery store and the restaurant, we might change our minds a little bit. So how much do you each agree or disagree in this citizen consumer paradox? Is it real? How does everyone feel about that? So I can see lots of people participating. Then it's pretty cool in the background. I've never been on the backside of this, so I see it's like a horse race with answers going back and forth. So we'll give it a couple more seconds. So hurry up and get your vote in. Forty-one to 54. So we've got a few more people that are either mulling it over or want to abstain, don't want to vote. It's not your civic duty here. So if you do want to abstain, that's fine too. All right. So it looks like we're done. So Liz, if you want to end the poll and show the results. All right, so you can see that there's quite a lot of agreement. Strongly agree, 38%, 42% agree that this dichotomy or paradox is there, and a few people that are disagreeing with it or strongly disagreeing. So I guess maybe it depends on your perspective of how you're interpreting that question. But it feels like it would be, feels like it's a real thing for many people. All right. So we'll end that poll. And, I see a, oh no, that's a direct message. Or is it, I'm wondering, Eva, are you sent me a direct message, but is a message you want for the panel? You can just let me know. Yes. Okay. All right. So I'll read out Eva. Eva's with NSF International. So that's an auditing company. And so she's asking, what would make it for Michael and other panelists in the global setting easier to quote unquote sell the NFAC code or allow the NFAC standard to be your company's program/requirements? So Michael, you were particularly targeted on that one.
It's a good question and something that we have, we're trying to figure out for ourselves because we do, we are the team that I work with, I'll say the Canadian Aramark team do advocate for alignment with NFAC within our sort of more international group. And while there's no sort of real mistrust or anything like that, I think it's just this kind of a perception that, well, it's just Canada. And so again, as I was talking about earlier, with sometimes a need to kind of create something that is a little bit more a little bit more broader in scope, a one size fits all kind of a solution. I think in order to get there, what we would have to convince them of is that this standard is, internationally speaking, as good or better than anything else that may exist. Now, that's not easy to do. I think we could certainly make a case for it. And I think there are some people that we've even managed to convince from other countries, other Aramark countries. But it's not easy. And that's really what we would have to do, is to be able to set up the codes as the best common denominator around which to build a kind of an international approach or message around animal welfare. So I don't know if that helps you. I think it may generate more questions than it answered, but it's
it's real. Great.
Yeah.
So I'll move on to the next question, unless someone really has a burning desire to add further to Eva's question.
I would add one small thing is I would love to see just more government support and endorsement of the codes, you know, just celebrating that, you know, they are in existence. And, you know, even, you know, during times when we're in trade agreements and we're, other countries are looking for access to our country to import things that might be controlled. Just celebrating the differences and the fact that we have a national system, I think, would drive more awareness and help create a brand for this that people would recognize.
Great. Thanks, Paulo. Always like those plugs. All right. So you guys have been so awesome. And so I have a ton more questions that we really want to get to. So I'm going to target one person to answer a question. And then, you know, if anyone else really wants to dive in, but we'll try and get through as many of these questions as possible. And we have one more survey question. If we have a chance, we'll get to that as well. So Angela, I specifically want to ask you this question, because you and I have had a bit of a conversation on this. So what do you think your sector can offer or is doing in terms of ensuring the achievability of the codes? So anything that you want to contribute on that one? So how does the retail food service restaurant sector contribute to the achievability of codes?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I did touch on it a little bit. It's this idea of long-term partnerships and relationships. And it's a recognition of the fact that making some of the changes required as codes get updated is very financially costly to producers. And so, entering into those long-term relationships allows them to make those investment decisions to either, you know, meet those requirements or recommendations in the code and know that they're going to have a customer. You know, we've talked about consumers, and consumers can be fickle and their opinions can change very quickly. So it is a balance between helping the industry get to where they need to be, but also, you know, responding to consumer interest. So that's, you know, we do try, if we're asked, especially if we're asking for something new or big, is to enter into a really long-term partnership to make that happen.
Great. Anyone else want to jump into that before we move on to the next question? All right. So next question, Jason, maybe I'll throw this one at you. Thinking about the diversity of consumer wants and interests, what would you say are the main market signals or trends now and in the next 10 years? Just put a whole lot on your shoulder to answer that question.
So to forecast consumer demand 10 years from now, oh my God. If you had have asked me 2 years ago, I would have given you an answer that would have been completely wrong. Who would have seen, you know, what happened during COVID, right? With surge in demand and all the stuff that we saw early on, and then, you know, during various phases of lockdowns and stuff like that. So I'm going to give you a corny answer, Jackie, but it is true. Is with consumers, it's you got to be nimble. You got to expect the unexpected. They are more savvy now than ever, have more access to information now than ever, and so it's really trying to uh, to, I think, expect the unexpected. And if I may comment on, you know, that the poll, you know, with regards to the idea of a paradox, I don't know that paradox is the right, is the word that I might use. You know, if you think about somebody, you know, that wants to buy anything, right? Like to buy a home or a car, they want great value. They want a beautiful home in a great neighborhood. And is, I guess, you know, that's a paradox, but as they should, as consumers should want selection and cost and responsibly sourced things, right? And so I think, you know, it's up to us as an industry, and it's up to retailers to you know, work with their suppliers and try to meet those very quickly shifting consumer demands. So it's maybe not the answer you were looking for, but it's expect the unexpected.
No, and I like how you shifted on the paradox, because I think you're right. You know, we all want to be doing the right thing, and then we look at, you know, what our bank account says, and sometimes we have to make different choices. yeah. Anyone else want to bring out a crystal ball and tell us what they think are the main market signals or trends now or into the next 10 years? Anyone want to tackle that before we move on? Oh, Angela is
jump in,
brave.
And then you mentioned the crystal ball. I did want to comment on that paradox question as well, because consumers don't always make the socially responsible choice, or they don't always make the affordable choice, but it's clearly, you know, social responsibility, animal welfare, those types of things are clearly very high on the list of factors to consider when consumers are making choices. And we can just look at, you know, the growth in organic products or, you know, other types of sustainable products to see that happening. So it may be that in a specific instance, they go into the supermarket and they don't buy the free range eggs, but I'd say that we can see increasingly that consumers will have those considerations near the top of their list. And that I don't think that's going to go backwards, and they are more and more savvy, and there's more and more information available. So yeah, they're not, you can't always predict what they're going to do, but I'd say at the top of the list is going to be sustainability, animal welfare, social responsibility.
Cool. Great. Great answer. All right. I want to
thank Angela for kicking the door open on the paradox as well, because I've been I wrote a note here just to myself saying, you know, the paradox is real but not absolute. So I think, you know, you will get people changing in the moment, going to the grocery store, you know, want to buy something, and then something else is discounted in the bunker, and you know, decision matrix kicks in. But I think where it really happens is it actually, you know, it informs people's choice on where they go in the first place. So what I'm feeling is a lot more consumers now want to align themselves with brands that are socially aligned with them. So, you know, I might want to be an A&W consumer because A&W says and does all these great things. So I may shift what I buy within, or I may, you know, within a Loblaws or whatever. But I think in the moment, people are apt to make changes and be able to be swayed. But I think where people align themselves and, you know, create loyalty to a retail or a restaurant is where these things come in.
Cool. Great. Oh, you guys are just really amazing. The answers you guys are giving, and really, really informative and helpful. And I am getting private, you know, direct messages telling me how much everyone is enjoying this. So really, really appreciate this. This is a really important question. So I want to open it up to not, you know, I won't direct anybody. I think all of you need to be able to weigh in on this one. So how well do the various commodity-developed on-farm animal care assessment programs meet your company's needs? So we're switching to assessment programs now, moving beyond codes and paradoxes. So how well do the commodity-developed on-farm animal care assessment programs meet your company's needs? And what would you like to see improved? Who wants to leap into that one first?
Well, I'm never shy, Jackie. I hear a little bit of silence, and I just, you know, I'm happy to jump in. So from a technical perspective, you know, at an association level, I wouldn't be as close to, you know, the audits and assessments as I think some of the member companies would be. What I would say again is the opportunity here is with with consumer awareness, right? Because I think one of the common perceptions or misperceptions or opportunities for further education around NFAC codes is, hey, entirely voluntary, right? And so I think an opportunity with regards to those assessments is to say, look, here are some of the audits that take place. This is what they look like. Here's what it looks like when you don't meet those requirements. I from my perspective, I think there's an opportunity to do some broader education there.
Cool. Yeah, great. Anyone else want to dive in on that one? Angela?
I'll jump on this one. I think the importance of robust assessment codes for us anyway can't be overstated. That's how we know the codes are being followed. Without those robust assessment programs, it's a document. So I think we can't overstate how important those are. And I would like to see more transparency, more reporting, what happens if you don't pass, exactly what Jason said, what proportion of industry is passing each year, how are corrective actions dealt with, that kind of transparency. We don't need to know individual farm level results, but that transparency over how well the industry is conducting the program is really important. And some sectors are doing a really great job of it at this point in time, and some are not in Canada. So I'd say that is they go hand in hand with updated codes is having credible assessment programs.
Yeah. Paolo, Michael, do you guys want to speak to that?
Not much that hasn't already been said there. That transparency and benchmarking, just to show, industry-wide doesn't need to be specific down to a producer, but having that benchmarking and showing progress, or even showing us places where we can do better, or where where industries that are customers of yours could lend support to help further an agenda or something would be good. But transparency and benchmarking are very important to us.
Great, thanks, Michael.
I agree with everything that's been said. The one thing I would add is that when we talk about transparency, sometimes even the transparency from beyond our walls, so to speak, or consumer awareness and transparency, I think even there's an opportunity for increased within the supply chain. Like, for example, we don't do, or we do very little purchasing directly from producers. There's almost always somebody in between, and not having enough transparency in understanding what their purchasing practices are sometimes can make it difficult to be able to make a commitment as a sort of a consumer facing organization, right? So somehow, and I mean, this definitely ties into the assessment programs and how well they're used, all the information that goes along with everything that's been said, but how that information passes its way up the supply chain, or all the way to the end of the supply chain, I guess, right up until the point of service. So I just point that out, because I think we've talked a lot about transparency, and as important as it is, I think we've been talking a lot about it as a sort of a public transparency, but I really do think there is an opportunity to improve it within the sort of middle of the supply chain as well.
Awesome. You guys have been so informative. This has been just a fulsome. I had more questions yet. We had another survey question, but your answers were so thorough and interesting. And this has just been a real pleasure to moderate this and to hear you guys all deliver such helpful information. Thank you for listening to NFAC Conversations. Watch for future NFAC Conversations podcasts coming soon. Funding for the NFAC Conversations podcast is provided through the Agri-Assurance Program under the Canadian Agricultural Partnership, a federal, provincial, territorial initiative.